Zondervan presents Weird, Because Normal Isn't Working by Craig Groeschel. Read by Tom Schiff. Introduction. Why I love being weird. Know what's weird? Day by day, nothing seems to change. But pretty soon, everything's different. Bill Watterson. From as early as I could remember, my life was pretty normal. As a child, I tattled on my sister, had a crush on the girl next door, and performed Evel Knievel stunts on my red 1975 model Schwinn bike with the fire-striped banana seat. Normal stuff for a kid, right? In middle school, I enjoyed playing soccer with my friends, watching reruns of Happy Days, and playing Truth or Dare with girls behind the library during recess. Again, pretty normal stuff. In high school, I ran for student government, counted down the days until I got my driver's license, and exaggerated to my friends about what I did on dates with the girls I used to meet behind the library. Typical teenage stuff. In college, I regularly overslept my 8 a.m. economics class, charged dozens of Domino's pizzas on my first credit card, and became a brother of Lambda Chi Alpha fraternity. Although I wouldn't have acknowledged it then, looking back, I see that being normal was my main goal. Fitting in felt infinitely better than standing out. I worked hard to dress like the rest, Levi's and polos were king, act like the rest, party hardy, study hardly, and in between chase any girl I meet, blend in like the rest, act cool no matter what, talk like everyone else so they'll know I'm as cool as they are. For me and my peers, normal was in. Nobody we knew wanted to be weird, except for that freshman we paid $10 to eat a live roach, but I think he liked the notoriety. Normal was cool, and weird was uncool. Normal people were winners on their way up. Weird people were losers headed downward. When your full-time job is fitting in, you rarely stop to contemplate the more serious issues of life. That is, until one of the more serious issues in life smacks you upside the head. All of us cool wannabes experienced such a blow one warm October night my sophomore year. Laura, one of the most normal girls I knew, had started driving the 3-hour trip home to see her parents. Like most normal college kids, she'd probably had much less sleep between late weeknights studying and late weekends partying than her body needed. And on that tragic night, she fell asleep at the wheel, wrapped her car around a tree, and died instantly. Suddenly, normal life didn't seem so normal anymore. Laura's death was so sudden, so unexpected, and so permanent. She was 18 and had her whole life ahead of her. Beautiful, smart, funny, she was just like all the rest of us. Only now she had a firm grasp on the meaning of eternity, something my normal friends and I conveniently avoided considering. Our school hosted a celebration service to honor Laura's life and to give us an opportunity to mourn. I sat silently on the end of the third-row pew in that tiny campus chapel most of us had worked so hard to avoid until then, aware that life was now different, but not exactly sure how. Suddenly, my English lit test and tennis match the next day no longer seemed so important. This was only the beginning. Without warning, my normal mindset started to bother me. Like a dull toothache that begins to throb, my discomfort with the way things were seemed to increase steadily. For years, I'd asked the questions normal people ask. Why won't the head cheerleader go out with me? What class should I take? Should I change my major? Am I popular enough? Good enough? Successful enough? Can I get a good enough education to land a good job and afford a good house and marry a good woman and have good kids, all so I can, what, be normal? With a kind of magnetic power, Laura's death now pulled me toward bigger questions. Is this all there is to life? Why am I here? What if that had been me dozing off behind the steering wheel? If my life ended now, Would it matter? What happens after you die? Is there really a God and a heaven and a hell and all the Christian stuff I've heard about? These new questions led me to do something totally abnormal for my frat pack of jocks and hardcore party people. Start a Bible study. I admit that, fueled mostly by my newfound fear and anxiety, I also saw an opportunity to improve our fraternity's free-falling reputation. And if I could pass off my new interest in God as a PR move, then my real motivation could remain secret. After all, normal people don't go around thinking about dying and eternity and the meaning of life every day, do they? And technically, it probably shouldn't have been called a Bible study. This was more of a try to read the Bible with a bunch of people who don't know squat about the Bible meeting. And for the record, I wasn't the Bible study type. While I wasn't sure what that type was, it seemed a safe bet that it wasn't the guy who hit on sorority girls at the weekly keg party. So despite the jeering and mocking of our friends, a few frat brothers and I gathered on a Tuesday night in a room affectionately called the Pit to attempt something none of us had ever done alone, much less together. Read the Bible. We started in Matthew chapter 1. I knew enough to start with the New Testament and not Genesis, and plowed forward the best we could. At the end of each gathering, we'd pray and ask God to keep us safe while we partied the upcoming weekend. Kind of different, I know, but that's where we were at the time. This Bible study attempt foreshadowed even more weirdness. Strangely enough, the more I read the Bible, the more it felt like God was starting to speak to me. Each day I read something that seemed especially personal and timely. Words of encouragement, or conviction, or forgiveness. Gradually, my heart started to warm toward God. Maybe he was real after all. Experiencing his voice through Scripture, I sensed he was gently drawing me, calling me, pulling me. As the spiritual tug continued to strengthen its grip, I started to contemplate what taking God seriously would mean. What if Jesus is real? What if his teachings are true? How would my life change if I truly tried to live like Jesus? What if I really gave my life to God? Although I didn't know all the answers, I knew enough to foresee that pursuing my new questions would force me to step outside the safe circle of being normal. Red Letter Weird. As I dived into my new passion for Bible study, I noticed that certain words were printed in red and not black, the words of Jesus, as if what he was saying didn't stand out enough. When I read what Jesus taught, it was anything but normal. His teachings were so weird that they could easily be considered otherworldly. Jesus said, "Love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who mistreat you. If someone strikes you on one cheek, turn to him the other also." Luke 6:27-29. Normal says to hate your enemies. Jesus says to love them. Normal seeks revenge on those who hurt you. Jesus shows you how to be kind to those who harm you. If someone hits you, then normal swings back. Jesus teaches you to turn the other cheek. Let's be honest, this is not only counterintuitive to everything we learned on the playground in elementary school, it's just downright weird. And these are not the most challenging of his unusual teachings. Jesus also told us to pray for those who persecute us. Weird. And if we want to find our lives, we have to lose them. Weirder. And if we don't hate our parents, we really aren't committed to him. Weirdest. Preparing for our weekly try to read the Bible with a bunch of people who don't know squat about the Bible meeting, I ran into two verses like a brick wall. Enter through the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter through it. But small is the gate and narrow the road that leads to life, and only a few find it. Matthew 7:13-14. These red, yelling words of Jesus struck me full force. Many are on the road to destruction. Few are on the road to life. Where was I? Was I driving with the flow of traffic racing blindly down the wrong highway? Or was I headed in the right direction, along with a few others, down a one-lane road? Although I wanted to believe I was one of the few, my heart knew I was stuck in a traffic jam. Jesus' words screamed like a big neon sign, pointing out a route that I had failed to notice as I tried to keep up with the convoy of normalcy. The truth of his words suddenly seemed so clear. The majority of people, the crowd, is traveling the wrong path, the one that leads to destruction. They're the normal ones, intent on looking like the rest, spending money like the rest, living like the rest, keeping up with the rest. But their road leads to a dead end. Only a few people, the weird ones, unafraid to exit the normal highway, find the right road. Not many, but a small and brave group of travelers willing to separate from the crowd and embark on a different kind of journey down a less obvious path. Talk about a major U-turn. Here I was, comfortably cruising down the interstate at 80 miles an hour, assuming I was headed in the right direction since everyone else was going the same way, when suddenly the GPS revealed that where I really wanted to go was in the opposite direction on a small back road. To really follow Jesus, to know him, meant that I'd have to be different from my friends and everyone else. But I didn't want to be different, one of those goofy Christians I'd seen around campus with their guitars and clever little tracks that weren't supposed to look like tracks. Christians were different, and different was weird, and I was committed to being normal. And since I didn't want to be weird, I wasn't about to change my course and follow Jesus. Weird 101. Who could blame me? Tell the truth. Haven't you noticed how weird Christians can be? You know what I'm talking about. That late-night, low-budget, cable-access Christian television weird. Not just big hair. Being from Oklahoma, I'm used to that. But also big purple hair. Pronouncing Jesus with the violent inflection of a carnival barker. Jesus! Be healed in the name of Jesus! Wearing suits in cartoon character colors and promising God's blessing in exchange for a monthly contribution. As I continued to wrestle with the conviction I experienced in reading Jesus' words, I was forced to rethink weird. What if being the Christian kind of weird did not mean the same thing as the bad weird, freak show, annoying, carnival barking, somewhat uncomfortable, weird for no reason weird? What if the Bible is talking about a different than what everyone else does, good type of Jesus weird? Although I had always believed in God, I had to acknowledge that I didn't really know him or what it meant to follow him. Maybe the weird I associated with religious people wasn't how he intended Christians to be different. Maybe there was a whole new wild world of weird that came with choosing the narrow path. Maybe it was time to abandon the normal and wide path I'd known and off-road it for a wonderful weirdness I couldn't imagine. After a Tuesday night Bible meeting, I walked alone to an empty softball field. No matter what it cost me, even being normal, I had decided that I wanted to know Jesus and live for him. I wanted to do life his way and not mine. As I knelt beside the dugout and prayed, I left normal behind and embraced whatever it took, being different to the point of the God kind of weird, to follow Jesus. Something melted within me, and I walked away forever changed with a sense of God's grace I can't describe. It didn't take long for others to notice the change. When I told my fraternity brothers and teammates that I'd become a Christian, they gazed at me with the tentative uncertainty usually reserved for wild animals and mental patients. They quickly realized, however, that I wasn't dangerous, just weird. In a matter of moments, I'd gone from a cool, normal, somewhat popular, regular kind of guy to a first-class Jesus freak. Perhaps the most immediately noticeable change was my commitment to purity. No more sex until marriage. To say the least, my sex-obsessed buddies thought I had really lost it and had drunk more than my share of the bad Kool-Aid. Several frat guys even wagered $100 that I wouldn't last 1 month without going back to my old ways. For the record, they lost their money. Normal's not working. I grew to love being the God kind of weird so much that a couple of years later, I became a pastor. Some of you are thinking, now that's really weird. And during this time, I've seen a lot of normal people, some seemingly working harder at it than others. They're everywhere. Even today, when everyone wants to be recognized as an individual, they're still wanting to be accepted for fitting in. However, nowadays, being normal isn't quite as easy and painless as it once seemed to be. In fact, it's more time-consuming than ever. There aren't enough hours in the day to buy, sell, drive, cook, clean, call, shop, eat, plan, study, write, review, schedule, and follow through on everything. Overwhelmed, overloaded, and exhausted, everybody talks about wanting more time, but only to catch up on what they're already doing. Rushing, planning, worrying, and rushing some more. Families suffer. Health wanes. Priorities fade. Joy evaporates. Most people don't know their life's direction because their soul is dizzy from spinning around so much. Uninterrupted time to rest, relax, and enjoy life sounds like a line from a retirement home brochure. Normal is busy and getting busier. When it comes to finances, it's normal to go into debt so deep that you can't see the way out. Money becomes a dark pit of worry, fear, anxiety, tension, and fighting. Most people I know are living paycheck to paycheck. Most make more money today than they ever have, but it's never enough. Now more than ever, it's expensive to be normal. So much cool stuff to buy and take care of. So many normal experiences you want your family to have. Only, it's hard to enjoy any of it when the financial noose tightens with each monthly payment. Normal relationships require little and provide less. You and your spouse are so busy, so stressed, and so exhausted, there's normally no time for each other. No wonder, then, that affairs are the norm. They provide the attention, romance, and sex without the commitment, sacrifice, or intimacy required in marriage. Similarly, you'd love to spend more time with the kids, but there's just not enough time. They're almost as busy and stressed as you are. It would be great to have deep, meaningful conversations and shared experiences that allow you to teach them what you know. Normal families, however, just don't work that way. And nothing's more normal than sex, right? Premarital sex, extramarital sex, friends with benefits type sex. Porn, experimentation, casual hookups, whatever feels good between consenting adults. It's totally normal. Maybe our parents were uptight and repressed about sex, but we're more progressive, more liberated nowadays. In the 21st century, why in the world would anyone remain a virgin until marriage? After all, as one of my frat brothers used to say, you wouldn't buy the car without test driving at first, would you? Unfortunately, though, normal also carries a hefty price. Guilt, shame, confusion, remorse, disease, addiction, unwanted children, and divorce. Normal infects our faith as well, both what we believe and how we live it out. When we consider how people relate to God, it's normal to either reject God altogether or believe in Him while living as if He doesn't exist. In churches, normal is lukewarm Christianity, self-centered spiritual consumerism, and shallow, me-driven faith. God has become a means to an end, a tool in our toolbox to accomplish what we want. The majority of people claim to know God, but by their actions, they deny Him. And all this is normal. But normal isn't working. Weird on Purpose. In this book, I'm going to challenge you to jump off the normal path and onto one that may seem a little weird, At times, you're going to argue, "But Craig, that's just too weird." When that happens, we're likely making progress. We're going to talk about dramatic changes. Because, let's face it, if small changes would have made the difference, you'd have made those changes a long time ago. Everyone travels along the wide road. Only a few take the narrow path. You certainly don't have to agree with all my ideas, but if you take the Bible seriously, I trust you won't deny that the way normal people live today is miles away from what God intended. Separating ourselves from what the world considers normal is not just a matter of obedience. God invites us to dance to a different tune because He knows what's truly going to satisfy and fulfill us. Instead of living stressed, overwhelmed, and exhausted, you can live a life of meaningful relationships, intentional scheduling, and deep, fulfilling rest for your soul. Instead of choking with constant financial fear and tension, you can let God's Word lead you along a path to financial peace, margin, and eternal investments. Instead of allowing your marriage to drift into parallel lives or divorce by default, you can experience true intimacy with your spouse. Rather than continuing on the normal sexual path toward pain, emptiness, and idolatry, you can allow God to heal you, change the way you think, and place deliberate safeguards in your life to protect you. God wants you to know Him and love Him, not just acknowledge Him or consider Him a cosmic sugar daddy. If you let Him, if you choose not to coast along the world's wide-open road, but rather to blaze a narrow trail with Jesus as your guide, then you'll never settle for normal again. You'll want only one thing, the God kind of weird. Chapter 1. Killing Time. When you kill time, remember that it has no resurrection. A.W. Tozer. Just before Christmas, my whole family piled into our kid-moving vehicle and rushed to the nearest mall to grab some last-minute Christmas presents before dashing to a holiday party. As usual, we were running late and were slightly on edge. Entering the mall parking lot, I was overwhelmed by the traffic. Cars crawled bumper to bumper, inching along like a million ants trapped in a puddle of honey. Instinctively, I prayed one of those selfish, "God, please get me a parking space," prayers, as if God wants me to get one before all the other ants. Out of the corner of my eye, I spotted an old pickup truck near the mall entrance, leaving its space. God is so good. I punched the accelerator and sped toward my answered prayer, hoping to gain a few precious extra seconds. I immediately staked my spot with eyelock. Eyelock is the ancient practice of claiming a spot by looking directly at it. As long as you don't look away, the spot is yours. Relieved that I might actually avoid the tedium of trolling up and down each aisle, I kept my eyes deadlocked on the spot and prepared for entry. Out of nowhere, a red sports car whipped in front of me, breaking my honorable eyelock, and stole my parking space. Unbelievable! Frustrated beyond words, and with the pressure mounting because of our tight schedule, I did something that I'm not proud of doing. While my wife pleaded with me and my kids prayed loudly, I backed up my vehicle, pointed it directly at the red sports car, shifted to neutral, then revved my engine. The driver of the sports car glanced into his rearview mirror, only to see me glaring at him. Like a drag racer leaving the gate, I popped from neutral to drive, peeled out, and shot straight toward the rear of the enemy car. It's hard to know what happened next. Maybe it was my wife threatening me. Perhaps God answered my kids' prayers. Maybe I realized that I was still in our minivan and not in a NASCAR race. Whatever the reason, right before impact, I slammed on the brakes and stopped just short of his car. With all the Christian love I had, I rolled down the window and shouted at the top of my lungs, "What do you think you're doing? You know I had eyelock, you idiot! Now you're going to make me really late, you red sports car driving loser!"
After rejoining the other ants, we searched for another 20 minutes and finally found a parking spot somewhere near the state line. Thanks to me, no one in my family had the Christmas spirit as we entered the mall, my wife barely speaking to me, running even more behind schedule. We dashed from store to store, breathing heavy in our rush. As we entered JCPenney, who should approach us but my old friend, the driver of the red car? Just great! Images of my picture with the headline, "Local Pastor Assaults Man Over Parking Space," flashed through my mind.
"I can tell you're in a big hurry," he said, as my blood pressure continued to rise. "But it appears you have more going on in your life than you can handle."
My wife gave me the "remember you're a pastor and better behave" look, as the driver continued.
"I'd like to tell you about someone who could really help. Jesus. I really believe you need him, and he could change your life." Ouch.
When more isn't better. I can't blame my lack of self-control on our culture, but it surely doesn't help any of us manage our time well. We live in a time-starved society that relentlessly pushes us to the limits, and not just at the holidays. Buy more, do more, accomplish more, conquer more. Rush, rush, hurry, hurry, more productive, more efficient, more expedient, more, more, more. It's insane what passes for the norm today. Most people work far more hours than they used to. Who works only 40 hours anymore, trying to get ahead or simply survive? Our evenings or off times are crammed with activities, the kids' sports, music lessons, and, yes, church. Many families rarely have time to eat together. A typical family dinner now includes a round of Happy Meals from the drive-thru in the 15 minutes between dance and soccer practice. Even kids are overwhelmed today. I know many families with 7 and 8-year-old kids who, on top of homework and school, are out 4 or 5 nights a week doing extracurriculars, not to mention the schedule they have to keep on the weekends. And in our culture, this is normal, or even expected. We all want our kids to be well-rounded, don't we? We wouldn't want to deprive them of the lifestyle necessities that their friends have, would we? For many of us, the schedules we impose on our children end up consuming us. If someone asked, "Are you really enjoying your life?" most of us would have to say, "No, and I don't have time to talk about it." We're always rushed, always on the move, never having enough time. Almost everyone I know has little room for error in their schedule. Tragically, most people have little time for the things in life that they would say are the most important to them. When we overschedule ourselves in the belief that we can do everything, we stop being human and try to become godlike. Not only impossible, but also incredibly arrogant. Most of us are living at a pace that is not only unsustainable, it's also unbiblical. Instead of our typical conclusion that we simply don't have enough time, what if we embraced the truth, no matter how weird or counterintuitive it might seem? You have enough time to do everything God wants you to do. God has given you everything you need to accomplish all that He wants you to do, including enough time. 2 Peter 1:3. We don't need more time. We need to use the time we already have differently. You have time for what you choose to invest your time in. Every day, most of us say, "I just don't have time to work out, to read the Bible, to go to church this week, to meet for lunch, to add one more thing." But the truth is, we find time for what's important to us. If golf is really a priority to us, we find time to play golf. If going to dinner with our friends matters, we make it happen. If tanning, working out, or getting our hair cut is a priority, we seem to find time. Catch yourself the next time you're about to say, "I don't have time" for something. Tell yourself the truth. Either it's not a priority and you're guarding your time for good reason, or you simply aren't willing to choose to spend your time on it. Normal people do normal things at a normal,
breakneck pace and never have enough time to do the most important things. This is why we are called to buck the trend of accelerating busyness and reset our race engines to God's speed. Fueled by faith and passion for our true priorities, we're going to drive against traffic in order to find rest, refreshment, and time for what matters most in life. A Tale of Two Sisters. Our constant busyness is causing us to miss more than just rest and refreshment. I'm convinced normal people miss the majority of God's blessings because they're too busy to notice them. Nowhere is this more apparent than in a scene of two women at odds over how they're each spending their time. One is convinced she doesn't have enough time. Her sister, however, accepts an opportunity for a unique encounter and, as a result, receives a gift with literally eternal payoff. As Jesus and his disciples were on their way, he came to a village where a woman named Martha opened her home to him. She had a sister called Mary, who sat at the Lord's feet listening to what he said. But Martha was distracted by all the preparations that had to be made. Luke 10:38-40. Here's what's interesting. Mary and Martha are both presented with the same opportunity. Jesus, the very Son of God, has come to Martha's home. What would you do if you knew Jesus was coming over? Now, Mary probably had other things she needed to do, just like the rest of us. Maybe she had laundry that wasn't done. She might have needed to go buy some groceries or kill the fatted calf. Talk about a time drainer. Certainly, she could have swept, cleaned, and tidied up. But she chose to create a moment instead. She said, "Right now, while we have this time, I'm not going to do any of that other stuff. I'm going to seize this moment and simply enjoy being with Jesus while I can." Mary made a deliberate choice. She wasn't being lazy and using company as an excuse to get out of helping her sister with chores. She was choosing to focus on what mattered the most. When's the last time you stopped long enough to embrace a matters-the-most moment? If you're like me, it takes a few reminders. Just last night, I was sitting in my home office replying to emails. My youngest daughter, Joy, bounced in to see me. With her long hair pulled back in pigtails and her mouth smudged with Oreo crumbs, she asked, "Dad, can we play a game?" Lost in my work, I mumbled the busy parent's creed. "In a minute, honey. I'm doing something important. Let me finish my work. We'll see. Maybe later." Without missing a beat, Joy blurted out, "Daddy, look at me and never forget this. I'm only going to be 6 years old once. You don't want to miss it." I smiled at her negotiation tactic. Kid guilt works every time. Nonetheless, my all-important work didn't seem so urgent anymore. I gladly closed the computer, stuffed an Oreo in my mouth, and sat down for an epic game of Go Fish. It's so tempting to let these moments pass us by because we're overwhelmed by everything clamoring for our attention. The task-driven Martha knew this too well. While Mary embraced the moment, Martha, on the other hand, was like many of us, preoccupied, distracted, busy being busy. Martha was wigging out. She was freaking. She was losing it. And here's the kicker. The distractions consuming Martha weren't bad things. She wasn't bent on doing evil. She wasn't enticed by the pursuit of something sinful. In fact, we might even say that her priorities were good and necessary. In all fairness to Martha, we might be thinking along the same lines if we were in her place. "Okay, I gotta think this through. This is Jesus coming over. The Jesus. Everybody's saying he's the Son of God, the Christ. I'd better get out the pretty Pottery Barn china with the little sparrows and fig leaves. I'm going to need new candles. I've got to make sure the toilet paper matches the shower curtain. I certainly want the Lord to have a good impression of our home and family. God forbid that we look like a bunch of pagans." Sound familiar? Just like Martha, we fall into the trap of being busy
instead of being bigger than the tyranny of the urgent. I've heard it said, if the devil can't make us really bad, then he'll try to make us really busy. Absolutely true. What's most important is often not what seems most urgent. When something small loudly demands all our attention, its noise often drowns out the whisper of what's enormously important. Martha becomes so intent on her mission that she can't imagine why anyone else wouldn't be doing the same things. Consider the urgency in her voice. Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to do the work by myself? Tell her to help me. Luke 10:40. However, she's not hearing her own message. Martha tells Jesus with her lips that he's the most important thing, Lord, even as she's absolutely convinced that all this activity is the right thing to do. Jesus, I'm doing all this work, making drinks with the little umbrellas, preparing special hors d'oeuvres, gluten-free with no bacon, unloading the dishwasher, staging the dinner table, and Mary's just lying around shooting the breeze. Are you kidding me? Martha not only misses the opportunity before her, she feels more than justified in missing it. Majority rules. Mary and Martha's dilemma is the challenge for all of us. Most of us are convinced that the way we're already living is absolutely necessary and right. Our culture, the world we live in, has brainwashed us. This is the way we have to live. Being really busy means you're successful, important, and significant. We become convinced that this standard, lots of important activity, the business of busyness, is what truly matters, an indication of our talent, worth, and value. Anybody worth anything will always be busy, right? In the introduction, I mentioned the eye-opening effect that Matthew 7:13 had on me at a crucial time in my life. Let's look at it again from a different version of the Bible. The highway to hell is broad, and its gate is wide for the many who choose that way. New Living Translation. Everybody's doing it. Well, if it seems like everybody's doing it, then clearly they're on a broad path. They're going through a wide gate. Many are choosing that way because the bandwagon requires a huge exit ramp to accommodate all its passengers. Notice that these verses start with, "You can enter God's kingdom only through the narrow gate," then continues, "The gateway to life is very narrow, and the road is difficult, and only a few ever find it." Matthew 7, 13-14, New Living Translation. So if it seems like you're doing something different from what everyone else is doing, and if sometimes that feels hard, this is a good thing, not a bad thing. When I compare the pace of my life with the rhythm of God's Word, it quickly becomes apparent I'm doing something wrong. Just because everyone else is doing something doesn't make it right. Wow, I just said something my mom told me for years. In fact, when everyone else is doing it, it begs for scrutiny. Instead of just naturally following the herd instinct and doing what everyone else is doing, what if we automatically questioned the majority rule? Again, like Martha wanting to present Jesus with a lovely meal in a beautiful setting, there may be nothing inherently wrong with popular behavior. It may even be a good thing. But is it the best thing? Normal people allow good things to become the enemy of the best things. Too many good, or acceptable, things quickly overwhelm the most important things in life. Too often our desire to fit in, to belong, to conform and be considered normal eclipses our desire to follow God and do what's best. We choose popular standards instead of the habits that lead to holiness. In his letter to the Romans, Paul tells us exactly how we can counter this. Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Romans 12:2. What makes us think that public opinion knows what's best? What gives the majority the authority to determine what's right? If we follow Christ, we're not supposed to be like everyone else.
The whole point of sanctification is to become more like Him instead of who we are when left to our own devices and desires. So how do we discern the difference between a good choice and the best one? Paul provides the answer with the second part of this verse. Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, His good, pleasing, and perfect will. Your to-don't list. Imagine meeting someone for the first time, and after making small talk, you politely ask, "What kind of work do you do?" Your new acquaintance replies, "I don't do much at all. I usually just hang out at home and wait for friends to drop by." What would you think? Most of us tend to look down on people who don't produce visible results and demonstrate their accomplishments. Why? Because we usually equate busyness with importance. This isn't just about worldly accomplishments. It's about spiritual worth as well. One of the foundational lies we've absorbed about the value of busyness is that it indicates our spiritual worth. If we work hard and get our lives together and do as many good and valuable things as possible, then God will be pleased. And since He wants us to have our lives together, then He must want us to keep working until we figure out how to get everything in our lives just right. This sounds right, doesn't it? Wrong. Most normal people believe that God will never give us more than we can handle. The problem is, God never said that. He said He would not let you be tempted without a way out. 1 Corinthians 10:13. But He never said He wouldn't give you more than you can handle. Ready for a weird take on this? God will often give you more than you can handle so you can learn to depend on Him rather than on yourself. If you could handle everything yourself, you wouldn't need God. Moses certainly learned this the hard way. Like many normal people today, he was overwhelmed with more responsibilities than one man could handle. As a leader of millions, he spent his whole day solving literally hundreds of problems. He finally became so overwhelmed, he cried out to God to take his life. In Numbers 11:16-17, God said to Moses, "Bring me 70 of Israel's elders, and I will take of the Spirit that is on you and put the Spirit on them. They will help you carry the burden of the people so that you will not have to carry it alone." If you have more than you can handle, God wants you to lean on Him to tighten your load. You don't have to do it all, and God doesn't expect you to do it all alone. All the more reason to allow Him to guide your decisions about your workload, schedule, and commitments. We must discern what God calls us to accomplish rather than mindlessly adding on everything presented to us. When you go to an all-you-can-eat buffet, it's tempting to fill 3 plates because everything looks so good and it's all included in one low price. There's fried chicken, grilled steak, mashed potatoes, glazed carrots, creamed broccoli, green beans, sweet potatoes, fruit salad, green jello, warm dinner rolls with honey butter, chocolate pie, and strawberry shortcake. But if you load up on everything available, someone will have to load you into an ambulance. You have to make some choices, both to savor what you do eat, as well as to maintain your health. Similarly, each day you may be tempted to bite off way more than you can chew. We have to remind ourselves that just because we can do something doesn't mean we should. Or think of it another way. If you're around my age, you might remember the old theme song to Schoolhouse Rock's Conjunction Junction. You remember, "Conjunction Junction, what's your function?" Ah, pop culture. If you don't have a clue what I'm talking about, you can pause and give thanks to God. One of the most important things we can do in life to combat busyness is change our conjunction. Instead of saying "and," we need to learn to say "or." Instead of fried chicken and grilled steak, we can have fried chicken or grilled steak. Instead of soccer practice and guitar lessons, you and your child can pick soccer or guitar. Instead of working late and taking work home,
It's one or the other. For example, right now in my life, on top of leading the church, writing this book, and ministering to pastors, I would also like to start an inner-city ministry and play in a soccer league and coach my kids' football team and serve on the board of the local homeless shelter and still have time with my kids. All good things and totally normal. But if I want to stay on the narrow path, I'm going to have to focus more deliberately, which means reminding myself that, in addition to my normal duties, I could start an inner-city ministry or play in a soccer league, or coach my kids' football team, or serve on the board, or spend time with my kids. Keeping an oar, O-R, in the water prevents filling your boat with so many good things that they ultimately sink the ship. While normal people continue to add items to their to-do list, maybe you should do something weird instead. Start a to-don't list. Just this year alone, I've dropped 7 things that I normally do to make room for those important things I thought I didn't have time to do. I'd like to challenge you to stop reading and start your to-don't list. Maybe you should do something weird and write down at least 3 activities in your life that you're going to drop. Put something down and let it go. Weird standard time. Why do so many of us lead jam-packed lives? Why do we plan to slow down one day, but then never actually do it? Why do we remain so busy, even as we complain about it and experience its constant erosion of our quality of life? Will you have anything to show for all the busyness, competitions, and activities besides ribbons, trophies, worn-out ballet shoes, and a hard drive full of pictures? How many world-class athletes retire with countless trophies but no family? How many entrepreneurs have a stellar 401k but don't know their kids' GPA? Or, as Jesus put it so clearly, how many people gain the whole world but lose their souls? Luke 9:25. If you're constantly burdened by the weight of all the many chores, tasks, responsibilities, obligations, and commitments in your life, then it's time to change. It's time to create a margin in which you can not only focus on your true priorities, but also simply breathe and begin to enjoy life again. If killing time is killing you, then keep listening. The next 2 chapters will examine the best ways I know for unplugging the busy machine that's constantly tailgating our lives. First, we'll look at practicing the power of being present, which sounds a lot cooler, hipper, new age, and zen than I intend, because what I'm talking about, as you'll see, is simply a fundamental awareness of God's presence in each moment of our lives. The second area is one you may know but don't practice regularly. Taking a Sabbath. Notice I said taking instead of observing the Sabbath. Knowing how to rest, to unplug, to unwind is as much a spiritual discipline as prayer or fasting. As weird as it may sound, God commands us to rest. It's not an option to keep going at the pace, intensity, and speed at which most of us live our lives. Busyness will remain the standard for many people for years to come. But we're called to a different standard, a way of prioritizing our time that may seem weird to everyone around us. When we follow Jesus, we're about our Father's business, not about the world's business. Check your watch. It's time to get weird. Chapter 2. No time like the present. You must live in the present. Launch yourself on every wave. Find your eternity in each moment. Henry David Thoreau. While in a restaurant recently, I noticed a family of 4 eating together. My first thought was, how nice. It's so great to see a family enjoying some time together. When I glanced their way again, each person's head was bowed, and I assumed they were praying before their meal. But when they kept looking down, I realized all of them were typing into their phones.
They were oblivious to one another. Each person focused instead on connecting with people who weren't even there. You've probably witnessed a similar scene. It may even have been your own family. It's not just texting and playing on our eye gadgets that's diverting our attention. According to Nielsen, the average person spends 28 hours in front of their television each week. This is in addition to the 16 hours a week, on average, that we spend in front of our computers. No wonder, then, that orthopedists see over 22 million people a year for thumb injuries caused by texting. Okay, I totally just made up that last one, but I'm convinced God intended more than texting and hitchhiking when He gave us opposable thumbs. It's not just busyness that's clogging our schedules and preventing us from enjoying the fullness of life as God intended. Maybe it's a chicken or egg situation, but I believe that the consequence of busyness destroys us more than the overwhelming stress of too much to do. As long as we're so busy, our minds and hearts are somewhere else, at work, at home, at the hospital, at the church, on and on. We're simply not present. Our minds are so cluttered with endless to-do lists that there's no room for us to experience the joy in being alive today. Present and accounted for. Right now, even as you listen to this, how many other thoughts are swimming around in your head? Normally, we all have so much on our minds, so many things to remember and get done. You have a lot going on at your job. You've got the big presentation on Wednesday that you haven't even started yet. How are you going to get it all done? Your kids have homework, including the big science project they've been putting off because you've been putting off a trip to Target for supplies, and they have to be at soccer. Oh, yeah, and there's the youth lock-in tomorrow night. The oil needs changing on your car, your yard needs mowing, and you need a haircut. You have to buy a wedding present for your friends from your small group. Which reminds you, the outfit you're planning to wear to the wedding needs to go to the cleaners. When you are with the people you love, chances are your mind may not be. In our small group of friends that meets regularly, I asked if this was a problem. Every couple in the room acknowledged this was a challenge for them. The wives in particular explained that even when their husbands were home, their husbands' minds often seemed to be elsewhere. And I'm as guilty as the next guy. For years, this was a normal scenario at our house. Amy would be talking to me about anything. Since my mind was elsewhere, I'd slip into barely acknowledging her with an occasional, uh-huh. After a few minutes, she'd abruptly ask, "Are you listening to me?" Then, with survival instincts, I'd quickly and miraculously repeat her last few words to prove that I was listening, even though both of us knew she did not have my undivided attention. My not-all-there problem is not limited to my private thoughts. I can also be at the movies on a date, at a dance recital, or at a family day in the park and still be working on my iPhone. Even though I'm physically present, I'm not mentally or emotionally present. After years of these normal distractions, Amy asked me to do something that seemed to wake me from a long relational nap. With a very understanding spirit, she explained, "I know you have a lot going on with the church. I'll always support you. But when you are with the family, can you be all here?" Her request was simple and more than reasonable. Wherever you are, be all there. I'll never try to pretend that I've perfected the art of being present. Far from it. But I've made drastic improvements. Normal people live distracted, rarely fully present. Weird people silence the distractions and remain fully in the moment. It's an unusual practice that can radically improve your quality of life and the depth of your relationships. 25:8. As we explored in the last chapter, simply having more time is not the answer. While busyness is categorically the norm for the vast majority of people in the Western world, the solution is never about having more time. We know this, but we still forget such an essential truth. People often say to me, and I'm guilty of saying it as well, "I wish there were more hours in the day. If only I had more time." And why do we want more time? What would we do with it?
We want more time to do the important things that aren't getting done. This list might include time to rest, time to spend with God, or simply time to enjoy our families and loved ones. But let's be honest with ourselves. What if God suddenly said, "I'm giving you one extra hour a day. You now have 25 hours in a day." Or better yet, what if He decided to give us an eighth day of the week, which amounts to over 3 extra hours each day? How would you spend that time? Would you use it for an afternoon nap, or to get caught up on last month's expense report at the office? Would you use it for a meaningful conversation with your spouse, or to get the oil changed, finally, only 1,000 miles overdue, on your car? Extra prayer and reflection time with God, or online surfing for the best deal on that flight for Thanksgiving? I suspect most of us would spend our new 25-8 time catching up on chores, doing more work, or finding long-lost grade school classmates on Facebook. Would you really spend a solid hour in meaningful conversation with your aging grandma or teenage son? Despite good intentions, I'm as likely as the next person to try to get caught up in all the areas where my life seems to be spilling over around the edges. The answer isn't more time, but a greater awareness of the time we have. It's like a car with wheels that aren't aligned. It always pulls to one side. If you don't constantly fight it, that little tug will drag you right off the road, and the constant battle to keep the vehicle within the lines becomes exhausting. No one wants to drive very far when they're out of alignment. The culture we live in is forever pulling us off center. Go faster, work harder, stay busy. If we don't fight it, we're not only headed for the ditch, we're back on the wide road with everybody else. Time out. Can you even imagine your life where you have time for the important and not the urgent? When one of your kids is talking to you, do you give them your undivided attention? Or are you also thinking about what to pick up for dinner or the deadline at work tomorrow? When someone interrupts you in the hall at the office, are you glad to talk to them? Or are you annoyed? Maybe that depends on the person. Do you have time to rest? No, I mean really rest. An uninterrupted night's sleep. A quiet morning over a cup of coffee as you watch it rain. A stroll along the beach as the waves erase your footprints. What's the last time you got to relax? Do you ever just sit and reflect on your life without watching the clock, setting the alarm on your iPhone, or becoming distracted by the laundry waiting to be folded? When you're with the people you love, do you connect intimately and enjoy each other? Or do you exchange essential information? I thought you already paid the American Express bill. Did you stop at the cleaners? What time is practice? That often leads to tension or an outright fight. Do you have plenty of quality time with the creator of this universe, the one who made you, so that all the other things fall into place? Or are you set on normal and usually lacking time for what's most important? When do you have time to be in the present moment? If you're feeling troubled by your answers, pulled from the present moment on a regular basis, then consider this admonition. Be very careful then how you live, not as unwise, but as wise, making the most of every opportunity, because the days are evil. Therefore, do not be foolish, but understand what the Lord's will is. Ephesians 5:15-17. Be wise, not foolish. Be weird, not normal. Don't let culture divert you from living in the present, being fully engaged with the people around you and the gifts and challenges that draw you back to God. Don't let the chaotic pace of normalcy tug you in the wrong direction. You'll have to fight against the daily drift, others' expectations, the urgent but unimportant, a false sense of self, or you'll get swept away by a normal life. Be different. Be careful how you live, how you plan, what you say yes to, and what you say no to. Notice the relationship between the choices we make, wise or foolish, and understanding the Lord's will. It's critical to God that we think about how we live, how we spend the present time with which we're gifted each day. How do you figure out what you should do with your time? In his book, The Best Question Ever, Andy Stanley offers a simple question you can ask to help you make the best decision in almost any situation. Let's say I asked you, "Hey, do you and your spouse want to go out to dinner with us Friday night?" If we already know each other, most of you would simply check with your spouse in your calendar, "Are we free that night?" While there's nothing wrong with this question, it's not the best question. Here's a better question to ask. Is it wise? Stanley explains that you have to know what's important to you, and that determines how you make wise choices, even about such normal decisions as whether to have dinner with the pastor and his wife this weekend. In light of everything that you know right now, all your goals, your dreams, where you are in your life, your personal experience, is this the wisest choice you could make? Consider the invitation I offered. If you pause for a moment to consider more than just your availability, then a variety of other variables might come into play. You've been attacking debt, so you've cut back on non-essentials like cable TV, buying electronics, and eating out. Knowing that you might have to charge the meal, or at least offer to tip, you decide it would be very unwise to go out. You've been working on your marriage. Your spouse has told you he or she wants a regular date night commitment, where just the two of you go somewhere to talk and enjoy being together. You farm the kids out to their friends to spend the night, or enlist relatives to babysit. Since Fridays have been your regular date night, would it be worth sacrificing just to hear Groeschel drone on and on about his upcoming sermon series on Leviticus? One or both of you are trying to lose some weight, so you've started exercising and eating more carefully. How likely would it be that you could pass up the strawberry cheesecake if you went out to eat? Given all these factors, and after further discussion with your spouse, your answer should probably be, maybe some other time. If that's the case, have the courage to tell me no. I'll get over it, I promise. You have to decide what things are important to you and can help you make decisions. Consider starting to ask, is this wise, with a wise criteria qualifier tacked on to the front. In light of our future hopes and dreams, with our current family situation, because we know our marriage isn't where God wants it to be, since I plan on going to graduate school, we have two children in diapers, so our 17-year-old will only be with us for one more year, so make your own list. What things are important to you right now? We're reminded in James that our time in this life is short and sweet. What is your life? You're a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Chapter 4, verse 14. Every day is a gift from God, so we must always ask ourselves whether it's wise to invest our time in the latest demand. You'll have dozens of opportunities, and therefore decisions, every day. Just because opportunities present themselves doesn't mean you should accept every one of them. It's not realistic, and it's also not wise. Often instead of asking, "Is this right or wrong?" or "Will I enjoy this or not?" we need to ask, "Is this wise in light of my desire to stay grounded in what matters most to me and to God?" How do you stay grounded in the present by scheduling wisely? You must have the courage to say no. You have to start saying no to good things so you'll be able to say yes to the best things. Too many good things quickly become the enemy of the best things. God calls us to think about time differently from the way most people regard it. We can stay engaged in today, aware of what's most important, or we can lose the present moment like water through our hands. Don't think like everyone else. Don't be afraid to be weird for being wise. Finding time. People tell me all the time, "Craig, your family is so weird." Compliment received. Seriously, I find so much comfort in that. The closer our family is to God, the more we stand out from the culture around us. When I'm focusing on what's important to God, I live differently. I invest my time differently. We're happy to be weird. Normal isn't working. But being weird isn't easy. Just like that night at the restaurant when I realized the family bowing their heads wasn't in prayer, I recently wondered why my house was so quiet. With six kids, silence is usually a signal that something's terribly wrong. Then it dawned on me. Every single one of us was immersed in technology. One person was on Facebook, one was working on her blog, one was sending tweets, one was playing Club Penguin and Webkinz, two were playing Wii, at least they were together, one was listening to her iPod, and one was watching television. Yes, my family really is the size of a small village. That was the day we decided to become weird. Amy and I together made a decision that was very controversial in our home. We limited the use of technology to only 3 days a week. This means that 4 days a week there's no television, no iPod, no Facebook, no digital animals you have to feed, even if they'll supposedly starve. After we unveiled our plan, our youngest son, Bookie, called an emergency conference. All the kids holed up together for more than an hour in a bedroom. Like a platoon leader plotting to storm the enemy line, Bookie led them through his detailed plan for a rebellion guaranteed to overthrow our evil regime. While learning to sleep with one eye open, Amy and I stuck to our guns, and amazing things started to happen. As we each gradually detoxed from our digital addictions, suddenly we rediscovered board games, Monopoly, Sorry, even checkers. We played charades, told stories, and, gasp, read books. I've played more matching card games than you could count with my six-year-old, and honestly, she beats me every time. Now we have epic wrestling matches that rival anything we has to offer, free-for-alls that include all six children spilling from room to room and out into the yard. We have favorite characters, David Copperfield, Anne of Green Gables, Captain Underpants. Memorable moments that become the standard for the all-time funniest thing that ever happened, and a lot of laughter. We listen to each other. What we have now is real. It's genuine. It's truly intimate time that we never had before as a family. And what made it possible was that we were willing to say no to the things to which everyone else says yes. We are far from perfect, but willing to be different. We're weird and blissfully happy together. If the average American watches 28 hours of TV a week, then by the time she's in her mid-70s, she's spent more than 10 years staring at an electronic box. Is this really how you want to spend your time? Too often the decision to go online, to Facebook, to turn on the TV, to channel surf, to play through one more level of Plants vs. Zombies is made by default. It's an autopilot decision, not a deliberate one. If we are to remain grounded in the present, then we must live deliberately. Losing your marbles. I read about a dad who realized he was so busy that he was missing most of his kids' lives. He never planned to take them for granted or deliberately choose to miss out on quality time with his kids, but he realized that his time with them would continue to melt faster than a popsicle in July unless he found a way to slow down and savor the present. So when his oldest daughter was a sophomore in high school, he did something that changed his family's life. The wise father purchased a bunch of marbles. Back at home, he carefully counted 143 marbles and put them into a large jar. According to the dad's calculation, he had 143 Saturdays left before his oldest daughter graduated high school and left home. So the father put 143 marbles in a jar, and each Saturday he pulled one out. The visual reminded him of the importance of investing his time in the places that mattered. It was inevitable that he would lose his marbles, but at least this way he got to decide where they went. Interestingly enough for me, my oldest daughter is a little older than his. I've got just over 100 Saturdays left before she will graduate and leave home. Even as I'm writing this, not helped by the fact that it really is a Saturday morning, I'm tempted to stop immediately and go find her so we can hang out. Maybe it's a compromise, but since I know I'll be with her later today, I'll keep working. Despite our best efforts, we're all losing our marbles. It's just a matter of how we'll enjoy each one. God gives us an amazing present every day. Normal people leave this gift unwrapped, unrealized, unappreciated, and it's gone before they know it. Weird people know there's no time like the present.